Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. Officials with the Department of Homeland Security say 500 of the 2,300 children separated from their families at the border over the past 6 weeks have been reunited with family members, but details are scarce. Immigration lawyers working with parents arrested at the border say they're getting very little information about where children are or how the government will find them.
This morning on Twitter, President Trump had strong words on immigration, blasting Democrats for telling, quote, phony stories of sadness and grief, and telling Republicans to stop wasting their time on trying to pass immigration legislation until the midterm elections are over. Joining us now to look at the politics we've experienced this week are Enrique Acevedo, news anchor at Univision. Hi, Enrique.
Hi.
And Tolu Olorunipa, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News, is with us as well. Hi, Tolu.
Hey there.
And Tolu, let me start with you. What is the latest on the plan to reunite these families that have been separated?
Yeah, we're getting very little information from the administration about what they've done so far, what they're planning to do to reunite more than 2,300 kids who have been separated from their parents as they crossed the border. We have heard very vaguely from the administration that more than 500 of these kids have been reunited with their parents since May, but we don't know when that happened, if any of that happened after the president signed an executive order earlier this week ordering the end of the family separation policy. It's very unclear. We have not been able to get very many answers from the administration. It does appear that they have been very they've lacked the focus when they have done this family separation to be able to put families back together, because it seems that they don't necessarily know where all the children are, where all the parents are, and what they need to do to bring the two together. It seems like there's a lot of challenges that they're going to face in trying to reunify these families, because it was done in such an ad hoc manner, the separation, that it doesn't seem like the various agencies are talking to one another, and it's going to be very difficult for these hundreds of kids who some of them can't recall the phone numbers of their parents or the names of their parents.
Right.
How to bring them back together is going to be very difficult.
Well, a Guatemalan mother seeking asylum was reunited with her 7-year-old son at Baltimore's Washington Airport overnight. Now, she had sued to get her son back, be reunited with her son after they were separated a month ago. Enrique, I understand you were on a reporting trip to McAllen, Texas this week and visited a detention center where 1,500 children are being held. What did you see?
Hi, Meghna. Well, first of all, let's remember these are the stories, the sounds, the images that the Trump administration is complaining about, the ones that they're saying that we shouldn't be focusing on or that Democrats are creating. They're very real. They're there. And if they would spend more time at the border, if the Secretary of Homeland Security, the rest of the cabinet, the president himself would spend time at the border, he would see that these stories are very real. And the stories are horrible, are things that I would never thought I'd see in the United States. Stories of family separation, the result of not just an extreme and cruel decision by this administration, but I think of years, of decades, really, of Republicans, hard right Republicans in the House, blocking any comprehensive immigration reform efforts.
Mm. Well, you watched a mass trial of immigrant detainees in McAllen, Texas. Let's hear a little bit of that.
Dennis Tecedo is 6492, separated from his 11-year-old son. Ms. Aguilera, separated from her 6-year-old son.
So what's happening there in what we're just hearing, and what's expected to happen to those parents?
Mass trials. Basically, you see a room full, a courtroom full of immigrants. They just arrived at the border. They're being transported from processing facilities to that courtroom. And the next thing you hear is each of them saying guilty, culpable, culpable, guilty, without sometimes a proper legal assistance or advice, which is, I think, a central component of what we call due process, a central component of the rule of law, something that you hear a lot from Trump administration officials. And that's what is happening. You talk to organizations, activists at the border, and that's what's missing the most, the proper legal advice and the proper legal representation for these immigrants.
Well, let's listen to President Trump yesterday. Here he is blaming Democrats for what's happening.
They want us to take care of the minors, and that's fine. But they don't want to give us the money to take care of them. because the worse everything looks, they think the better they're going to do.
Now, Tolu, administration officials have provided multiple explanations for what was happening at the border. They said that the policy, the zero tolerance policy, was a deterrent. Then they said it wasn't. It was a policy. Then it wasn't. Officials were following the law. Then it was the Democrats' law. Then only Congress could change it. And it turns out that President Trump could undo it with a stroke of a pen in his executive order. What does this tell us about the Trump White House?
Yeah, they've been all over the place. It's been very chaotic. They have had a lot of trouble on the messaging of this and in trying to explain what they're doing to the American people, in part because it's difficult to explain a policy of separating parents from their children. It's something that's vastly unpopular with the American people of all different stripes and all different political backgrounds. That's why you've seen so much backlash from even Republicans saying that the president should reverse course. When you heard the president say that the Democrats won't give the money, it's not necessarily money to take care of the kids. The president wants money for a border wall, and he wants a lot of immigration restrictions, and these children are getting caught up in that political battle where the president is saying, you know, Democrats won't come to the table and give me all of the things that I want on immigration, including a border wall, including all this money for new immigration officials and immigration enforcement officials, and changes to so-called loopholes. So these children are sort of being caught up in that political battle with the president saying he wants Democrats to come to the table.
And Congress not doing anything, at least just yet. A conservative bill, including a border wall, failed yesterday. Republicans' leaders postponed a vote on the Republican-written, quote, compromise bill until next week. And yesterday, House Speaker Paul Ryan was asked what Plan C was if it fails.
So we will cross that bridge if we get to it. But a lot of our members want to be able to express themselves by voting for the policies that they like.
Enrique, is anything going to happen on Capitol Hill, especially after President Trump's tweet saying they should wait till after the midterms to do anything?
Right, Jeremy. First of all, let's just be very clear about what happened here in the last 3 months. The Trump administration rolled out a policy to separate families without having a plan to reunify those families. And that's very clear, and it's becoming more evident each day. Then back to Congress. Just in 2013, Senate passed a bill, which was more a border security bill than a comprehensive immigration reform bill, I'd say. But they passed a bill, and then, again, hard right Republicans in the House blocked that. It didn't even get to a vote, despite the fact that it had the support necessary to be passed through the lower house. And it's happening again now. I don't think Republicans within the Republican Party can agree on a bill that would get enough support to go through the House at this moment. So like it happened with the repeal of Obamacare. So we're facing that very evident reality of Republicans not agreeing, despite the fact that they have majorities in both houses and they control the White House and most of the local governments around the country.
Mm. Well, let's listen to Minority Leader, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. She scoffed at the idea of a compromise bill.
It is not a compromise. It may be a compromise with the devil, but it's not a compromise with the Democrats in terms of what they have in their bill.
Tolu, where are Democrats on immigration legislation? And, I mean, is there any desire at all to actually work towards something that would be a palatable compromise?
Yeah, Democrats say they had an agreement last year where they were going to provide President Trump about $25 billion to build a border wall in exchange for protecting the Dreamers and making sure that there's a DACA fix. But then President Trump and the administration started wanting to add different requirements, including cuts to legal immigration, and that really kind of blew up the deal. Well, when you heard Speaker Paul Ryan say that our members want to have an opportunity to vote on something, that sort of flies in the face of what this whole exercise has been in the House, which has been a way to block the discharge position, which was sort of this organic movement by Democrats and Republicans signing a discharge position so that they could have a series of various different votes on bills that that different members wanted to vote on immigration. And the leadership blocked that by putting together various bills that ended up not having support to pass. So Speaker Ryan is basically trying to shut out the Democrats by getting rid of the discharge position petition while putting up bills for the floor that don't have enough support to pass, but allow Republicans to vote on their conscience. So it does appear that Republican leadership has sort of cut out the Democrats from this process. And President Trump is saying that we'll have to wait until the midterms. And much of what will happen will have to depend on what happens during November voting period.
I want to ask about one more thing on this issue, Enrique. And I really, truly do not understand what the message was here. But Melania Trump's jacket yesterday, she went to visit the border. She went to visit a facility where people were being held. And She wore a jacket that said on the back of it, "I really don't care, do you?" Do you have any sense of what that was about at all?
I have no idea, Jeremy, and I think we should all care about what's going on in this country, not just at the border. Going back to the question about the wall, in the end, Trump will succeed in building his wall, but it won't be a wall at the border. It won't be paid for by Mexico. Trump's wall will divide Americans inside the U.S. It already is. It will keep isolating this country from the rest of the world, and I think it will be paid for by generations to come.
Tolu, do you have any idea what that jacket was about?
Well, if you listen to the first lady spokesperson, it's just a jacket, it's just a fashion statement, nothing behind it, no hidden meaning. But the president says it was a swipe at the fake news media, and it was basically a sense that she doesn't care what the media thinks about her. Hard to say with this administration. You hear different explanations from different right. people in the administration. So we'll just have to wait and see what the true story is.
That's Enrique Acevedo, news anchor at Univision, and Tolu Olorunipa, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For more than 2 months, violence has gripped the Central American country of Nicaragua. At least 170 people have been killed and many more wounded. The crisis began on April 18th after pro-government gangs attacked a small student demonstration. Since then, a political crisis has swept the country, with activists calling for Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega to step down. Delphine Schrenk is chief correspondent covering Central America for Reuters. She joins us by Skype from Honduras, just back from Nicaragua. Delphine, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
And give us a sense of what is going on. You were just in Nicaragua recently, but you've been following it closely. What is it like there right now?
It's really pretty amazing. In the capital, Managua, and in towns around Managua, and actually across the country, what you see in the streets is sort of bricks have been pulled up from the streets into barricades, and they're being manned by fairly young-looking protesters. A lot of them are students, but there are many others who are masked in bandanas, and they're pointing morteros, homemade projectiles made of bits of scaffolding. And they're being attacked basically daily by police or associated forces in plain clothes. And in addition to that, you've got protests every day in the streets of people marching with Nicaraguan flags and hooting horns and basically all calling for the ouster of President Daniel Ortega.
And why do they want him ousted? What is their chief complaint?
So the short-term complaint is that, as you mentioned at the top of this, since April 18th, there have been protests, and the crackdown was very severe, so much that people were killed in the streets. And people have been inflamed and outraged by this. And instead of pulling back and admitting this, President Ortega has sort of doubled down. But that stands on top of incredible frustration, as I was hearing over and over and over, from Ortega consolidating power since he took over as president in 2007. This is his second stint as president since he was a big guerrillero leader back in the 70s and 80s.
Right. He's been a big political figure there for four decades now.
Indeed. So he was one of the leaders of the Sandinista revolutionaries who fought to oust the previous dictator, Anastasio Somoza. Then his party, then the Sandinistas, they lost power for a while. And then he took power again in 2007. And he became more of a moderate figure. But in that time, since 2007 to now, he has remained in power. People accuse him of rigging the last elections. There's evidence that he and his associates neutered the opposition. So he's been steadily encroaching on power, and there has been no credible opposition until about now. I think that's changing. I think this protest is creating a momentum for real opposition.
One of the things that's surprising about this is that these student protesters who started all of this were protesting not about something involving being a student, but they were protesting pension reform.
Yes, great point. As people there said to me over and over, including those students and student leaders, that was really just a spark. In fact, what had heated them up, the students particularly, only 2-3 weeks before, the government had completely mishandled, in their eyes, a raging wildfire in a biosphere reserve far south of the country. The government hadn't put out a raging fire, and students had tried to protest then. That protest had been put down. And over and over, I was hearing that protests in the past had been nipped in the bud very quickly by police, but also by these paramilitary forces. So people were saying to me over and over that this has really just been sort of an excuse. This was the tipping point. And again, it's sort of been the repression of this protest that really led to people getting furious. And this time they've been able to pour out into the streets. There's been no way to contain people all over the country.
As you know, here in the United States, one of the big stories has been all of the migrants who have come over from Central America, many of them fleeing violence. Is the United States getting involved in any way in what's going on in Nicaragua?
The United States has been putting a lot of, I think, behind-the-scenes pressure diplomatically. I was talking to officials in the State Department and, you know, on the ground there, it's very clear that the embassy there is working very hard to help with brokering peace. There has been an on-and-off national dialogue between government representatives and members of civil society and the economic sector, brokered by the church, but the U.S. has been influential in that. The U.S. has been talking behind the scenes and recently imposed visa restrictions on certain high-placed individuals. So in that sense, the U.S. has been more politically focused. I think it's a slightly separate problem to the problem of other Central Americans who are desperately trying to reach the United States. Those tend to be from where I am right now, Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. Right. Nicaragua, shockingly, has actually been one of the more stable countries of Central America until recently. And that's why this turnaround is all the more surprising.
And how much longer could this violence go on in Nicaragua? Is it expected to get any worse?
I think your guess is as good as anyone's. I think what I have been observing is, you know, this is following the dynamic of a pretty typical sort of street protest revolution. And what's very clear when you're there, and especially now, is different sectors that had supported Ortega have pulled away from him. So in that sense, I think Ortega's days are numbered. What is not clear is that right now he still seems to wield the brute force, as people there say as well, and is very evident in the death toll. And he seems to be digging in, although there is more and more a call for early elections. There's a call for his ouster. We'll have to see.
That's Delphine Schrank, who is chief correspondent covering Central America for Reuters, talking with us about the situation in Nicaragua. Delphine, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
This year marks the 50th anniversary of a decision that ended a perilous chapter of the Cold War. In 1968, the Pentagon halted a program that kept military bombers in the air loaded with nuclear weapons to deter an attack by the Soviet Union. The problem was the jets kept having near catastrophic accidents. WUNC's Jay Price has our story.
To understand why those bombs were being flown around, you have to consider the national mindset back then. Here's a U.S. government film.
The threat of hydrogen bomb warfare is the greatest danger our nation has ever known. Enemy jet bombers can drop bombs on any important target in the United States.
Thing is, the Russian jets we feared so much never dropped nuclear bombs on us. But we were so worried about them that we kept dropping bombs on ourselves.
Yeah, two bombs. Two warheads, I understand.
In 1961, an Air Force B-52 bomber came apart in the sky over Earl Lancaster's farmhouse north of Goldsboro, North Carolina. One bomb floated down gently on a parachute.
Huge parachute hanging in a tree. Of course, they come got that one pretty quick.
It came startlingly close to detonating. A secret government document said three of the bomb's four safety mechanisms failed, and only a simple electrical switch prevented catastrophe. A second bomb buried itself in a tobacco field. Now, you might think that that would be the only time the Air Force accidentally bombed its own country with an atomic weapon. Unless you drive a bit south, near Florence, South Carolina, and park in front of Mari Sanders' house. Then walk into the scrub oak and brambles to a water-filled round pit the size of a small house.
Well, it's the hole from where the bomb had dropped years ago.
The nuclear core, at least according to most reports, wasn't in that bomb. But the conventional explosives used to trigger it destroyed a farmhouse and injured half a dozen members of the family who lived there. And then if you head south to the next state, Georgia, in 1958, an Air Force bomber jettisoned a nuclear bomb into coastal waters near Savannah. It was never found. The military's name for serious nuclear weapons mishaps is Broken Arrow. Stephen Schwartz is a longtime nuclear weapons analyst.
The Pentagon has only ever officially acknowledged 32 Broken Arrows, but there is evidence compiled by the government itself that shows that there were thousands of these accidents over the years.
He says a wave of serious accidents in the late 1950s through 1968 was partly due to programs that kept the U.S. on a war footing. A few planes were kept aloft 24 hours a day, ready to drop bombs on Russia.
Of course, no nuclear weapons accident ever resulted in the actual detonation of a nuclear warhead or bomb. And for that, we can be grateful to our engineers that designed these weapons. But we also have to give a lot of credit to just plain old dumb luck.
The causes of individual accidents were sometimes almost silly. The South Carolina accident happened when a fumbling crewman hit the wrong switch and started to fall out with the bomb. He only grabbed a handhold at the last instant. Another accident happened after a crewman put seat cushions on a hot air vent. They started a fire and the crew had to bail out.
All of these things are designed, operated, and maintained by human beings, and human beings are fallible.
It wasn't the bombs we dropped on ourselves that finally ended the airborne alert program, but two accidents over friendly nations. In 1966, a B-52 bomber broke apart in the sky near the coast of Spain, where conventional explosives scattered radioactive material. Then came the burning seat cushion crash off the coast of Greenland.
It was immediately after that accident that Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara canceled the airborne alert program. He'd seen enough, and he decided that the risks were just too great.
If you know where to go, you can still see reminders of the time when we kept bombing ourselves, as a few dozen curious tourists do each year at Maurice Sanders' house in South Carolina.
I think it's on some kind of map or something, because sometimes you see people with paper in their hand, like maybe they may have downloaded something. Then some just park right there and just walk on back, you know.
Where they see evidence of just how lucky we were. For Here and Now, I'm Jay Price.
Jay's story was produced by the American Homefront Project. That's a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans.
The news can feel like an echo chamber. You listen to podcasts to get that perspective shift. So travel with NPR's Rough Translation. Follow familiar conversations in unfamiliar parts of the world and get a new perspective on home. Rough Translation. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Protesters in Pittsburgh shut down part of an interstate last night following the fatal police shooting of an unarmed 17-year-old named Antoine Rose Jr. in East Pittsburgh Tuesday night. Rose was shot while running from a car during a traffic stop. He was a passenger in a car believed to be involved in another shooting earlier that night. For more, we're joined now by Anlie Herring, government reporter at WESA in Pittsburgh. And first of all, what more do we know about Rose?
Antoine Rose was a student at a high school in the Pittsburgh area called Woodland Hills, which has gotten a lot of attention recently for issues relating to gun violence. In the last year or so alone, six African-American boys in this district have been shot. Four of those were fatal, and none of them occurred on school property. But it is an issue that has really gripped the community. As far as Antoine is concerned, he has been reported to have been very beloved in the community. He volunteered at a local charity and he worked at a local gym club. People say he was very bright and he was known for being a good writer. His English teacher read a poem at a memorial for him where he says he is confused and afraid. And one of the lines in the poem says how he observes mothers burying their sons and how he never wants his mother to feel that pain.
Hmm. Now, I mentioned that Rose was shot while running from a car during a traffic stop, but what more do we know about the circumstances that led to this shooting?
Not much more information has come out beyond what's already been reported, except yesterday the Allegheny County Police Department did release the name of the officer who, as far as I've heard, admitted to shooting Rose. His name is Michael Rossfeld, and he was with the East Pittsburgh Police, which is a suburban force. Sometimes people think it is within the city of Pittsburgh. And he actually had just been sworn in hours before the shooting occurred, though he had been patrolling in East Pittsburgh for a few weeks before that. And he also had 8 years of policing experience leading up to that with a couple of municipal forces in the Pittsburgh area and also with the University of Pittsburgh.
I see. And how is the department itself responding? Is there going to be an investigation? What more are they going to be doing?
The East Pittsburgh Police Department really hasn't said anything on this. The investigation will be led by the Allegheny County Police Department as an independent agency. And this is really common practice in Pittsburgh because we have a lot of very tiny municipalities, so the county often provides that oversight.
I see. So then tell us a little bit more about the protests that have been happening. What are the protesters saying? Does it seem like they may continue?
I mean, the protesters are very upset, and the emotions range from anger to frustration to sadness. And there's also a real sense of resolve to get more political power in Pittsburgh. A common theme is that people really want to hold the district attorney accountable because they view him as not prosecuting officers in these use of force cases aggressively enough. So that is a theme to these protests.
Well, Anli Herring is a reporter for WESA in Pittsburgh. Anli, thank you so very much.
Thank you very much.
President Donald Trump's zero-tolerance policy has put a spotlight on the asylum process in the United States. According to an analysis by the American Immigration Council, an immigrant advocacy group, around 20,000 people were granted asylum in 2016, down from nearly double that number in the early 2000s. But it's a big increase from the 1990s. In order to be granted asylum, one has to prove they face persecution based on race, religion, nationality, membership in a social group, or political opinion. But how does the process itself actually work? Well, Jeffrey Hoffman is director of the Immigration Clinic at the University of Houston Law Center. He's represented asylum seekers in the U.S. And Professor Hoffman, first of all, what percentage of people who apply for asylum in the United States actually get it?
Yeah, so the grant rate has been declining for several years. And if you look at the grant rates, especially with respect to immigration court proceedings, they've been declining. And the rate of people who have been denied asylum is actually going up. Right now, it's between about 60 to 70% are getting denied, and that rate is increasing. So it's very troubling. Some judges are even above 90% denial rate.
Okay. And is there a reason why? Because it's always up to a judge's discretion, isn't it?
Well, it is a discretionary form of relief, and that's true. But, you know, lately, the interpretation of particular social group relating to various requirements under the Immigration and Nationality Act is changing. And so if they're interpreting the act in a more restrictive way, that could affect the grant and denial rate of asylum.
I see. So let's talk about the process then in a little bit more detail, because I think there has been a considerable amount of confusion and even misinformation about it over the past couple of weeks. First of all, do you have to be in the United States on U.S. soil to first make an asylum claim?
Yes, you have to be at the border or you have to be in the interior of the United States. You have to meet the definition of refugee. So that's where the confusion comes about in the public consciousness. So there is a definition of refugee in the Immigration Act. And so if you're seeking refugee status, then you're outside the United States. If you're at the border or in the United States and proving that you're a refugee, then that's called seeking asylum status.
Okay, so let me be sure I understand this correctly. So if you can claim refugee status outside the United States, but inside the United States, you can seek asylum.
Correct. So the definition of refugee is found in the Immigration and Nationality Act, and it's the same definition, whether you're trying to prove that you're a refugee outside the United States or you're trying to prove that you're an asylee here in the United States, you have to meet the same definition.
Okay. Now, I understand that people who apply for asylum or seek asylum are supposed to be given what's called a credible fear interview to determine if their claim that they are being persecuted in their home country is legitimate. That process can take some time. And what happens to people as they're waiting? Some are getting detained now. Has that historically been the case?
Well, historically, people have been detained for a short period of time. And then when they pass their credible fear interviews, they're supposed to be released. Unfortunately, right now, you know, we're looking at, as we saw with the family separations and now the family detentions, that there's the possibility of people being detained for, or even families being detained for an indefinite period of time. So that's definitely something that the United Nations and other groups have criticized. We don't want asylum seekers to be detained, because if they're detained, they have a lot of impediments to seeking asylum. For example, difficulties in access to counsel and difficulties in access to making their case for asylum.
Right. Now, about that credible fear interview, what exactly are asylum seekers asked? And the reason why I ask you that question is because, you know, we've heard stories of people gaming the system and making claims about their fear of persecution, or coached about making certain claims that may or may not be true.
Well, so the credible fear interview process is a process where individuals, officials from the asylum unit, part of USCIS, which is Citizenship and Immigration Services, they are specially trained. They are, going to go into detail and ask many, many questions about the underlying basis for the persecution claim. I think the real issue here is the asylum seeker has to show a significant possibility. That's the standard. A significant possibility that they will prevail in the future in seeking asylum. So they don't have to necessarily have any corroborative evidence at this point, but they need to be able to create a narrative that is true, that will satisfy the adjudicator that they have a significant possibility of asylum.
Mm. Now, as you know, the president said earlier this week that smugglers, human traffickers, he says they game the asylum system. I mean, is that true? Are there people who cross the border illegally and then, if they're caught, just claim asylum, whether or not they're actually seeking it?
Well, so that's always the fear, that's the fear-mongering that's part of the current administration. They're going to point to the very, very, very few. And in my experience, and I've been an attorney for many years, yes, there may be some bad apples, but you can't throw out the baby with the bathwater and, you know, paint with such a broad brush that everyone should be denied asylum.
Mm. Well, so let me ask you then, because I think there's a deeper question here over exactly who asylum laws are meant to protect. And let me just play a little bit of tape here, because Attorney General Jeff Sessions reversed a court decision allowing a Salvadoran woman who had been abused by her husband to stay in the country. Now that was the original court decision. The Attorney General reversed that. And he argued that domestic abuse is not grounds. He believes it's not grounds for being granted asylum. So here he is speaking in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Asylum is available for those who leave their home country because of persecution, fear on account of their race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group or political opinion. Asylum was never meant to solve all problems, even serious problems, that people face every day all over the world.
Jeffrey Hoffman, I wonder if you could respond to that, because I think what the Attorney General is trying to get at there, and he basically says it, is that asylum is designed to protect people from persecution from their governments, and not necessarily other individuals or groups. And so therefore, he doesn't think we should be granting asylum to people who claim, fear of domestic violence, gang violence, etc.
Sure. So the first point I would make about the matter of AB, Attorney General's decision, is that if you read the decision very closely, he says on like the third page of the decision that he's not saying that never would he grant asylum to people who are seeking protection from private actors. So right there, if he's conceding at that point that it's not a blanket prohibition, but that there are certain situations where private actor persecution would enable someone to prove their asylum claim, then we have to ask, well, in what situations would he still grant asylum? And, the issue of private actors, the asylum definition is very clear under the Immigration Nationality Act, because what it says is that you have to show, even with private actors, that the government is unable or unwilling to protect the person. And so if the asylum applicant, even under, this decision that was issued by the Attorney General, if the asylum applicant is able to show that the government in their home country is not able to protect them from, let's say, domestic violence, let's say gang violence, and that they have a sufficient connection to one of the five grounds under the act, race, religion, political opinion, particular social group, etc., then that person should still be able to get asylum.
I see. Now, finally, I wonder if we could just take a step back here, because, of course, there have been major waves of asylum seekers coming to the United States in years and decades past. I'm just wondering, what were the reactions to those previous waves? Were they just as controversial, or are we seeing something different this time around?
Well, I think you raise a very important point, and others recently have written very eloquently about the fact that this country has seen waves and waves of refugees. We saw refugees, obviously, right before World War II, and we as a country took in many refugees at that point. And we have to adhere to our values as a country, and we can't turn away these people. And we shouldn't, you know, be in the situation where we're thinking of these people as an infestation or invaders or, you know, some of this negative rhetoric that we're hearing. Because what it is it's dehumanizing. It's beneath us as a country, and it's quite frankly embarrassing.
Well, Jeffrey Hoffman is director of the Immigration Clinic at the University of Houston Law Center. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
By the way, most of the people granted asylum in the United States are from China, according to the latest data from 2016. That's partly because of the country's restrictive family planning policy.
ABC has a new dating show in its lineup. It's called The Proposal. Think of it as The Bachelor, but where that show takes a whole season to whittle down contestants, this one does it in one episode. That's right. Two people go from strangers to fiancés in under one real-time hour. We're joined now by NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Hi, Eric.
Hey. You know, what could go wrong?
Well, and this show comes from the same person who did the TV special that came out in 2000 called Who Wants to Marry a Multimillionaire? How has The Proposal updated that model?
Well, not very much, to be honest. Multimillionaire was a pageant that featured 50 women. They start with a much smaller number on The Proposal. I think they start with 10. And they can't see the guy who is eventually going to propose to them, and they don't know anything about him, although the audience is told about him. So here's a clip from the show where the announcer sort of sets up the premise and lets you know how the person who's picking these women is going to be shielded from their view. Let's check it out.
It's time for our mystery man to enter his pod, where he'll see and hear everything that happens on stage, but no one will be able to see him. While the women are sequestered backstage, let's meet our mystery man.
Sounds like right out of the 60s, Eric, I have to say.
Yeah. Well, now, one of the problems with Who Wants to Marry a Multimillionaire is that the multimillionaire turned out to be someone who had something of a past. He had had a restraining order taken out against him by someone that he'd been in a relationship with before, that the woman that he chose at the end didn't find out about until the show was over. So there was this huge controversy. Now we have someone, this guy I think is a police officer, someone who's much more sympathetic, someone who seemed to be much more upstanding. So one way they tweaked the show was to find a better man to pick from the women. But I also think we've just kind of gotten used to this kind of show, and so it doesn't seem as weird to see it on television as it seemed way back 18 years ago.
Well, one of the things in the news recently was that the Miss America pageant dropped its swimwear competition. This show, The Proposal, actually prominently features one. Let's listen.
These seven beautiful, brave women made strong first impressions, but we're just getting started. In a moment, they'll get the chance to let Mike know who they really are. And because physical compatibility is a large part of falling in love, they'll be doing it in their finest beachwear.
Wow, sounds like it'll work perfectly in the Me Too era, Eric.
No, I couldn't believe I was watching it. I saw a screener of this that ABC provided in advance, and I was like, swimwear? Didn't Miss America just? Oh, no. And it was really odd, too, because, you know, one woman came out and showed pictures of her family in her swimwear. Another woman came out, and they had talked about her proficiency at baton twirling, but it also turned out she's a neuroscientist. So she's talking about her job as a neuroscientist while in a red bikini. Aye, aye. The thing that really surprised me the most, though, was that ABC aired it. And, you know, the president of entertainment for ABC is an African-American woman. So obviously the executives there thought it was okay.
Well, ABC also aired Roseanne for a while. Have they faced any backlash from this, the proposal?
Well, of course, the show got a lot of negative reviews, but nothing along the lines of the backlash that Who Wants to Marry a Multimillionaire got. And, you know, what worries me about these unscripted shows, and I know it makes me sound like an old-fashioned scold, you know, back in my day or something, but these shows, I believe, lower our resistance to damaging messages and, in particular, to the way in which women get treated on these dating shows. And, you know, I've criticized The Bachelor for a long time about this. Like, Mike Fleiss was the creator of Who Wants to Marry a Multimillionaire, the executive producer and creator of The Bachelor. He's also the executive producer of The Proposal. And so The Bachelor was a way to tweak what he tried to do on Who Wants to Marry a Multimillionaire that the public rejected. They drenched The Bachelor in all of these trappings of romance. So they go to these exotic locations for dates. There's a lot of hand-wringing and talking about, you know, do you love this person? And is this someone you could spend the rest of your life with? And they stretch it out over the course of a series. Here, they've compressed it all down to one night. And the problem with that is that you're resorting to all of these sort of stereotypes and these archetypes to judge the people who are vying to be proposed to. But we're so used to that now that it doesn't cause the kind of immense rejection and controversy that Who Wants to Marry a Multimillionaire did so many years ago.
You also have to think, if it's not just for show, it seems like a strange way to get into a lifelong relationship with somebody.
I just can't imagine that it would work.
Right.
I can't imagine that this is anything other than a manufactured relationship that eventually will go the way of all things.
And then they'll come up with a new show called The Divorce.
Apparently. Yeah. But the dangerous thing about that is that you're setting forces in motion that you can't really control. ABC doesn't really know what these two people are going to do. And indeed, with Who Wants to Marry a Multimillionaire, the woman who was picked filed to get the marriage annulled based on the stuff she was finding out about him after it happened. And there was a sense that the network had been negligent in setting up that situation in the first place.
Right.
It's a recipe for disaster, and I'm surprised that they aired this on national television and have more episodes scheduled to air.
It's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans talking with us about The Proposal on ABC. Eric, thanks as always.
Always a pleasure.
And some late-breaking news today. The Hollywood Reporter says ABC is pulling the second episode of The Proposal after a woman accused a contestant of facilitating her sexual assault last year. This is Here and Now.